Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. 45 years ago, in late August 1970, a protest against the American Legion both galvanized and polarized Portland, Oregon. The following is a personal recollection scribbled to assist an interview with Dory Hilton, who wrote a paper on the affair. It has been subsequently tampered with or with revisions and additions, and represents my opinion only in probably all the cosmos, universes, and newly discovered planets. I call it the People's Army Jamboree. I spent most of 1966 and a few months of 1967 as a USMC combat correspondent in Vietnam. My job was to travel with infantry grunts and sometimes reconnaissance patrols and record with words and camera our experiences in conflict with Viet Cong guerrillas and North Vietnamese Army. My weapons were an increasingly battered and rusty M14 rifle. I claimed rice grew out of its barrel. Various pens, pencils, and spiral-lined notebooks I stuffed in my pockets, and a 35-millimeter Nakanos underwater camera that got as beat up as my rifle. I quickly accepted the war's grim circumstances, but no amount of Star-Spangled Banner justified the horror of indiscriminate eco-genocide against Vietnamese, who mostly died because they were in the way of our guns and napalm. I survived my one-year assignment to war by embracing the thought that guilt was the provenance of the living only, though I refrained from personal atrocities. Alive and back stateside, I attempted to keep the promise of my accepted culpability. I was an early member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, VVAW, and helped organize chapters of disaffected Vietnam veterans all over the country. I was a rather forceful speaker at the time, blunt but oratorical, voicing my hatred for the war and the militaristic imperialism at its root. Each opposition to the Vietnam War had its own logic and internal history. For most veterans, it was either sympathy for Vietnamese and remorse for assisting in their slaughter, or antipathy toward the war from the point of view it wasn't worth the life of a single American. Regardless of their reasons for opposing the war they fought in, many wounded, crippled, or mentally scarred, the usual attitude toward dissenting veterans was as traitors from the right and baby killers from the left, though both attitudes were to change. I estimated that for every vet who made public his or her protest, perhaps 10 to 100 were in quiet sympathy, restrained by marriages, jobs, or other considerations. The first time I heard about the American Legion's plans for a convention in Portland, the summer of 1970, was the previous December, when a reporter from the Oregon Journal, a Vietnam veteran, told me the Legion was coming and suggested something ought to be done to confront their unconditional support of the Vietnam War. The most logical opposition would be Vietnam veterans, he said. It would be momentous for Vietnam veterans to directly challenge the Pentagon's war policies through the American Legion, which rubber-stamped every military ambition and pretension. As it turned out, Vietnam Veterans Against the War spearheaded the Legion protest, but were actually only a small part of the amalgamation of Northwest anti-war organizations and individuals that became involved, a gaudy hodgepodge of war resistors, idealists, ideologues, and malcontents who mirthfully self-named the demonstration the People's Army Jamboree. The idea of doing something about the presence of the American Legion in Portland was thought about through the winter and spring of 1970. After a student anti-war strike at Portland State University ended with a bloody police attack in May, organizing to protest the Legion convention became front burner priority. It was unfortunate we had so long to wait, almost 3 months. By then, the devil of partisan factionalism had subdivided us nearly to the point of dissolution. People who had been recognized as leaders of the local anti-war movement resisted relinquishing stature and power to newcomers who evolved into grassroots leadership from the ranks of barricade persons who had become the heart of the Portland State student strike, living together for 6 days behind accumulations of furniture and rubbish. The same shift of power occurred during organizing of the People's Army Jamboree. The new group that had emerged from the strike was voted to lead the PAJ in a tumultuous meeting of most of the esoteric groups who were to participate, representing the myriad variations of Oregon's small counterculture, with the distinct exception of black activist groups. I was elected titular mouthpiece of PAJ because I represented VVAW, which was publicly promoted as confronting the Legion. Ultimately, however, significant power remained with the old leaders, who opened negotiations with Portland city officials for a site in which to encamp whoever came to town to protest. At this point, the two factions started clawing at each other. One attempted to retain control by dealing with the city and encouraging fear that Portland would be invaded by hordes of hippies. The other split rail sent off warnings to stay out of Portland because it might be an ambush to cripple the anti-war movement. This faction, the newcomers, which included me, also supported the governor's innovative rock festival, Vortex, which was inspired to deter incoming dissidents from Portland. Our support was from concern that police did not distinguish pot-smoking music lovers from hardcore political radicals. With the cultural side of the counterculture movement removed, the streets of the city were open to the political side, which would be free from worry that its activities would harm the spaced-out hedonists. Paradoxically, participants of a rock festival being held at the same time in Washington State, Feather River 2, came across the Columbia River and joined our protest. I was not a very good organizer, but I had talent as a frontman. I made speeches. Local and network media interviewed me. I was allowed semi-equal time on local radio and television to counter an uncharacteristic diatribe by Governor Tom McCall against the People's Army Jamboree, which I compared to a speech by Adolf Hitler in the early 1930s to prepare public opinion for the upcoming Final Solution. I spent little time in an office rented in the city's Burnside District for organizing the People's Army Jamboree. Many people worked long hours every day without pay to put the affair together. I played grasshopper. When my presence or tongue were required, I was usually found at Rubens Five Tavern. I used to think Rubens Five regulars were queen bees of the liberated future. Maturity unblinkingly redefines us as just another tavern crowd, despite our exotic disguises, esoteric philosophies, and wanton behavior. Yet in the summer of 1970, we bartenders at Rubens Five arranged our working schedules around our political activities. Rubens Five was our center. We drank wine and beer and smoked illicit herbs outside and dithered about arcane and esoteric particles of political theory, none of which would survive reality, but sounded impressively radical. Rubens Five was at its peak that summer, featured in local and national media as the colorful headquarters of the baby boomer rebels. Hunter S. Thompson, the original and probably world's only gonzo journalist, commandeered several tables in Rubens Five the entire Legion convention, a blonde woman and a dark-haired woman on either side of him like bookends. Press and TV reporters interviewed anybody at Rubens Five who would talk to them in the weeks before our intensely advertised clash of pro-war and anti-war veterans and allies, soon to appear live in Portland, while undercover police agents self-consciously sat at the bar. Articles and newscasts escalated the tension, as did rumors that a hippie army planned to invade and take over Portland, and that residents had bought out the city's stock of aerospray oven cleaner to be used in defense against left-wing barbarians. There were also rumors and substantial evidence that a trap was about to be sprung upon us. The city was to be packed with police from all over Oregon and most of the state National Guard. The rest would surround the revelers at Vortex 1. A U.S. Army unit from Fort Lewis was to be stationed just across the Columbia River in Washington State. A few of us suspected a slaughter, a testing of how much public opinion would be strained by aggressing a bunch of dope-smoking, long-haired, usually white, hippies in a far-off, not very prime city in the rustic upper-left edge of the country. The previous year, police had attacked and killed several Black Panthers in a number of cities with hardly a murmur from the mainstream, known then as the silent majority. The Portland media portrayed the People's Army Jamboree as if it intended to maraud Portland like a biker gang. Sympathetic National Guardsmen told us they were being trained in summer camp to attack hippies. Perhaps the sum of these parts didn't add up to our paranoia, but we who were paranoid would have been irresponsible to not attempt to prevent the possible disaster we were paranoid about. We few wary conspirators staged a clandestine operation to keep people out of Portland. We sent messages and made telephone calls, no email or internet in 1970, to radical groups all over the country, warning them and explaining we didn't desire to attract fatal attention. We also allied ourselves with the efforts to organize the Vortex Festival, which would draw off non-political hippies and suck up out-of-staters on the road for Portland. We told everybody else that this was our demonstration, and we wished to do it ourselves. In the meantime, we participated in negotiations with the city. We applied for parade permits and argued for the use of a city park for our counterculture encampment. We wanted beautiful Washington Park for our campground, which we visualized as a final romp of flower children among the park's famous roses. We got instead Delta Park, former site of the city of Vanport, which was washed away by a Columbia River flood on Memorial Day 1948. Frank Ivancy was City Parks Commissioner. We all considered him an evil, ambitious man, perhaps our single consensus, whose deceit had caused bloodshed during the spring student strike. Ivancy made headlines resisting our arguments for a park and condemned our plans of protest as traitorous and communist-inspired. He later used media accounts of his stout resistance to hippie disruption and a photo of a future state judge and me as villains in campaign literature for mayor, which he eventually became after three attempts, but was not reelected. So we bickered with the city for most of that summer while dreaming up a demonstration schedule as logistically complex as a military campaign. We were bequeathed $10,000 by a local potato chip heiress and rushed to waste the money as rapidly as we could. Some very sophisticated radio equipment was purchased ostensibly to monitor police and National Guard movements during our days of rage. $1,000 was given to a local hippie lawyer as a retainer for a possibly heavy caseload in the near future. Another grand was used to purchase an offset printing press from a state auction, which printed small poetry books for years afterward. An uncounted and unattributed amount of the $10,000 disappeared into throats, noses, lungs, and bellies, alcohol, food, and drugs. Probably the worst thing that could be done with a fringe group is give it money. Fights break out immediately as to where the money will go and to whom. Entire socio-political movements have been hopelessly splintered, arguing about money donated by sympathetic donors. That $10,000 almost disintegrated the People's Army Jamboree, and by the time we were able to regroup, half the money had been spent with little accounting of where it disappeared. We worked for most of the rest of the money we received, hats in hand, in my case, tongue out of cheek. A TV appearance or a guest shot on talk radio was good for donated bucks, as were orations at open or closed gatherings of diverse radical and liberal groups engaged in various anti-war agendas. I was even a guest speaker at a luncheon of the inner sanctum of Portland political economic muscle, the City Club, though I don't believe I inspired any donations for the PAJ. By the time the American Legionnaires marched into Portland, everything seemed anticlimax. Tensions and fears had been so relentlessly exploited in the weeks and days before their arrival that the event itself was played through at half speed with a large sense of deja vu. We conducted our descent peaceably to the contempt of the national media, which had gathered in Portland and considered our lack of bloodshed proof we were lightweights. A columnist for the Washington Post, Nicholas von Hoffman, wrote, "The People's Army Jamboree is a lot like the Loch Ness Monster. Everybody's talking about it, but nobody has ever seen it." I presented an idea at the final hysteria pitch meeting of the PAJ crowd before Legion Week, which I thought was a radical departure from standard radical practice. A young girl walks through downtown Portland's deserted streets. She is about 8 years old. Her hair is long. She wears a dress. She carries a flower in one hand and a sign in her other hand. "In the War" is printed in bright paint on the sign, which is a piece of wood nailed to a stake. She walks down the middle of several empty streets. On each side of every street, against buildings or grouped in open spaces, are armed policemen and state national guardsmen. They watch the girl menacingly. She sings only one song, "We Shall Overcome." The girl would have to be 8 or 9, not much older, or she risked rape. It would be a feast for television, I argued. Just a lone little girl, virginal, anybody's daughter or little sister, marching past the assembled might of the government. Look at the contrast. Focus on the little girl in the empty streets. Close-ups of snarling cops wrapping their palms with riot sticks. National Guardsmen with bayoneted rifles. Various forms of paralyzing gases in handheld canisters. Newscasters' pompous voices edged with contempt at the uniformed brutes clustered in sinister ambush to molest the little girl. Perhaps split-screen the girl with marching American legionnaires. No chance. The crowd wanted to march en masse. Do the usual hippie demonstration shtick. After most of a summer spent in tense anticipation and growing public hysteria for our spectacular, no one wished to stay out of whatever action was ahead. Everybody was impatient for the performance to begin. Yet, for all the tense impatience, we were obsolete at the very moment of our presence. The real war was for racial and sexual equality, as well as for economic justice. The coming decade crashed whatever peak of economic equity had been reached in the post-World War II years. Our protest of an unpopular war was already being upstaged by more enduring struggles. Everywhere the People's Army Jamboree appeared the week the Legion was in town, it was ringed with concerned citizens who offered themselves as a buffer between us and the armed forces of law and order. They were a well-publicized group that called itself People for Portland and included nuns and ministers as well as average everyday folk who were worried about violence between police and hippies. Among them, a future gubernatorial candidate defeated in state Republican primary who later fled to Florida because he owed money, loads of money, in shady dealings. Encounters with police were mild, which probably disappointed a few on both sides of the People for Portland rings. My own tactics to keep the trigger on safe were to roam among marching demonstrators and quell outbreaks as they occurred, which generally meant pointing out troublemakers as police provocateurs, some of whom probably were. I didn't care. My intent was to isolate belligerent loudmouths before they gave police the excuse to attack. We had a few undercover agents and informers within our ranks. One was a young rookie cop who had been a Marine in Vietnam and intentionally bonded with me from that mutual experience. He fooled me, and I defended him against accusations that he was a spy. Yet he was a factor that none of us were arrested. Instead of provoking us to violence, which were probably his original orders, he defended us, reporting to his chief that we did not intend to commit violence or illegal acts and were prepared to internally prevent violence and crime. Another reason we might not have been put in jail was more obscure and involved a chance meeting with Oregon Governor Tom McCall. My friend Sailor John McGarrity, whose political grasp was brilliant, and I were walking downtown one afternoon a few weeks before Legion Week. We discovered McCall at the center of a small crowd cutting a ribbon to something, flanked by stacks of watermelons. Sailor and I instantly agreed I should talk with the governor, which I did as he walked a few blocks back to his limousine. McCall was a tall man with a lanky stride. I nearly ran to keep a pace of him while rapidly notifying him of our intentions and warned him when we reached his car, his bodyguards politely behind us, that our informal chat might cause him to be subpoenaed if any of us were arrested. Prisoners in the Oregon penitentiary later said they were moved to the state prison farm to make their cells available for the mass of protesters expected to be arrested during Legion Week. But none of us were. We marched three times through Portland streets. I made speeches before each march, but as a male was dissuaded from the second march, which was organized and conducted by feminists. I lost all copies of my first two speeches, which, if the third is an example, is not much of a loss. My rhetoric was full-sailed as I whipped up the crowd for a final effort. We walked into an armed camp, unarmed, against three times our number, I said, of the first two marches, which was not hyperbole. Law enforcement greatly outnumbered us. We brushed against the teeth of a lion, I said, and marched out again. We refused to give them any reason for their club-swinging orgasms. I felt like I imagined Billy Sunday felt, exhorting his flocks to wrestle sin, when I said, "We are marching once more into the hostile storm which frantically perpetuates war, racism, and sexism, and can only answer our peaceful demands with guns, gas, and clubs." Fewer of us protested the presence of the American Legion in Portland than attended the Vortex Rock Festival in Estacada. The national media were disappointed we did not provide a bloody spectacle, as were members of the various deployed police departments. Proof that the confrontation was overblown from the beginning was apparent when President Richard Nixon, who had planned to make a war speech to the Legion, sent in his place Vice President Spyrokakis T. Agnets, a Greek-American who referred to everybody else as Dagos, Fat Japs, etc. Some say Nixon was frightened of being attacked, possibly assassinated. I think he realized the political insignificance of appearing in a substantially diminished political melodrama. The pre-convention display of hysteria had a sobering effect, and in the end, no one wanted to be responsible for the violence almost everyone feared or claimed to fear. Portland's residents did not wish a reputation for bloody civil war. That determined pressure to avoid violence was powerful enough to prevent it. 45 years later, my most lasting memory of the People's Army Jamboree versus the American Legion is of Arthur Honeyman, who was born with cerebral palsy, being hoisted on the big shoulders of a large man just out of prison for draft resistance, raising his spastic right arm above a horde of armed security agents, and his quivering social finger pointed aloft for the attention of the Vice President of the United States, registers more clearly in my mind than the Torch of Liberty in New York Harbor. It might seem quaint to remember an anti-war protest from nearly half a century, from a previous millennium even. The People's Army Jamboree seems as though it were a nostalgic set piece. Instead of one war, the country seems now poised for several wars and clandestinely involved in a couple of others. A few of the presidential aspirants even promise war as a part of their campaign platforms. One particularly spurious candidate said he would declare war on Iran Inauguration Day. Most of us claim to be against war, but it seems to be a static response to doing anything about it these days. And I would like to add a footnote about Hunter Thompson's appearance in Portland during American Legion Week. Gonzo One made Rubens Five Tavern his literary office for the week, ordering pitchers of beer that he shared with anyone who blundered into the bar. He might have had more fun if he had gone to Vortex and made Mania. But for all his crazed antics, his prolific intake of heavy drugs, Gonzo Man was a deadly serious opponent of misused power. He consistently and bravely wrote some of the most original and clarifying treatises on the excesses of despotism, grotesque and fiercely satiric metaphors of the grossness of predatory power. He might have written something similar about the bitter but peaceful confrontation between pro-war and anti-war veterans in Portland, or he might have concluded with the Washington Post Van Hoffman that although everybody seemed to talk about the People's Army Jamboree, nobody had ever seen it. Whatever Thompson might have written, if he did, nobody seems to have seen it. One of Thompson's friends said after his suicide in 2005 that nearly every person who came into contact with him, however briefly, had a story about him. There might be a million stories about the Gonzo that he provoked, his visit to Portland. A letter writer to the New York Times a couple of days ago said that the American people are a ridiculous people, and someday they will get their just deserts. That's how he spelled it, deserts. And that might be exactly what he meant. And now before I close for this week, I'd like to read a flurry of birthdays that occurred in late August and early September. A friend's, a cousin, and one niece. Her birthday was August 8th. Her name is Tracy Ann McCusker, and she has written two books of poetry. The cousin has been family matriarch since my mother's death 8 years ago, and she was my first best friend when we were kids, Linda Combe Kanya, who is 75 as of August 15th. David Horowitz was 74 on 8/17. He has recently written a fine autobiography of his life as a historian and teacher, Getting There. The magnificent Cannon Beach artist, Stephen McLeod, would have been 71 that same day. He died in May. The Shanghai Lady of Astoria, Judy Nyland's birthday, was Tuesday, August 18th. Today is Cher Venera Waksmith's birthday, August 20th. Former state legislature for Clatsop County, Tom Hanlon's birthday is tomorrow, the 21st. My favorite twins, Lily and Donna Joy, DJ, Doofel, celebrate their natality the next day on August 22nd. And Lee Miller, the third twin, is also August 22nd. Julie Conception and Michael Horowitz both claim to be VJ Day babies, Julie on August 14th and Michael September 2nd, each born on those days in 1945, 70 years ago. And last, and certainly least, my 74th birthday was yesterday, August 19th. And I share that birthday with Bill Clinton, who was 69 on the 19th. He was the first president younger than me, and everyone since has been. And Orville Wright and his sister Kate and Coco Chanel were born on August 19th. And I almost forgot, on August 21st, Barbara Hansel, former godmother of Astoria Booksellers, who owned Parnassus Books, shares her birthday with former state legislator Tom Hanlon on the 21st. And this has been Michael McCusker. I guess I might be around next week if the sky doesn't fall or the river doesn't rise or the hill fall down.